Our reading is the first two chapters of the book of Nehemiah. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, "Those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire." When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Then I said, "O Lord, God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and obey his commands, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's house, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly toward you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, 'If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then, even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant, and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. I was cupbearer to the king. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, 'Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart.' I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, 'May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire?' The king said to me, 'What is it you want?' Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, 'If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried, so that I can rebuild it.' Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, 'How long will your journey take? And when will you get back?' It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. I also said to him, 'If it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates, so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah? And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple, and for the city wall, and for the residence I will occupy? And because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my requests. So I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. By night, I went out through the valley gate toward the Jackal Well and the Dung Gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved on toward the Fountain Gate and the King's Pool. But there was not enough room for my mount to get through. So I went up the valley by night, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or nobles or officials or any others who would be doing the work. Then I said to them, "You see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace." I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. They replied, "Let us start rebuilding." So they began this good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. "What is this you are doing?" they asked. "Are you rebelling against the king?" I answered them by saying, "The God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it."
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a new series where we're looking at the book of Nehemiah. So this may not be an area of the Bible, a part of God's history with his people that you're not so familiar with. So as we start at the beginning of this book in the Old Testament, let's just have a think about where we are in the history of God's people. Here's a rough timeline of part of the Old Testament. Now you may remember that the nation of Israel was established when Moses led the people from Egypt across the deserts, Joshua led them into the Promised Land, and then they settled in the nation of Israel. They had some judges who helped to lead them for a while, and then they established kings like King David and King Solomon. And there were several kings in this line, but unfortunately, even from the time of David, even from the time of Solomon, things started to go wrong. The people started to rebel against God. And at one point, about 950 BC, the nation split into two different kingdoms, Israel in the north and Judah in the south. Now, both of these kingdoms continued with some good kings, some bad kings, some very bad kings. Israel was destroyed, essentially, by the Babylonians. Judah carried on a bit longer, but eventually they too were taken into exile in Assyria. Now they did return, and the period that we're looking at is in this period on the very far right hand side when they've returned from exile. Let me put up a few names that you may recognise. So we've got King Solomon in the United Kingdom, and then as Judah continues, there are various prophets who align with different times in this history. Some prophets who speak into the exile, like Daniel and Ezekiel, and some like Haggai and Malachi, good names to be mindful of at the moment, and Zechariah, who speak into the return from exile when the people are trying to rebuild the nation, rebuild what they once had. And the two main leaders in this time are a man called Ezra and a man called Nehemiah. And it's Nehemiah that we're going to be learning about in today's passage. Now, the first thing we learn is that he is a man of prayer and passion. So we start off with this little narrative that he was in the citadel of Susa. So this is the centre of the Mede and Persian Empire. We're in the centre of this map here, a long way away from Jerusalem. And so we don't know how long he was there for, maybe his entire life. And he gets news from one of his brothers, Hanani, who comes and tells him about what life is like in Jerusalem. The exiles have returned. They're starting to rebuild. So in the book of Ezra, which comes just before Nehemiah, they've rebuilt the temple. They're starting to offer sacrifices again. So you might assume that things are going quite well. So it may be that Nehemiah is expecting quite good news from his brother. He's excited to hear about how his family's doing. But actually, it's quite the opposite. Look at verse 3. He says, "Those who survived the exile are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire." Now remember, this is a violent time when different tribes were fighting against each other, and a city without a wall was incredibly vulnerable. It was unprotected. And the temple and the people inside the city would be easy pickings for any raiders or attacks from nearby tribes. So how does Nehemiah respond to this news? Well, let me say, how do you respond to bad news? How do you respond when you hear about Christians who are struggling in other parts of the world? It would be easy to say, "Oh well, I'm really sorry to hear that, and I'll be thinking of you. Maybe I can make a little donation to an overseas aid, to the Jerusalem Aid Society, or maybe I'll pray for you a little bit." But see what happens to Nehemiah in verse 4. "When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven." So he doesn't just pray, he prays with fervour for several days. He mourns, he fasts, he prays, he's overcome by grief. And you see, he really identifies with the people. He even identifies with their sin. Look down at verse 6. "I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you." He's not just a far-off remnant, a distant relation of these people. He's very much in their heart. They are in his heart. Notice also that he prays very boldly. He asks God to be attentive, to listen to his prayers. He says, "Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses. If you return to me and obey my commands, I will gather you from there and bring you to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name." He knows his God. He knows God's promises. And he prays with great boldness, but also with humility. Humility and expectancy, fervour and perseverance. This is a great example of how to pray. He doesn't say, "Oh well, Lord, please send someone else. Please send someone to help these people." He says, "Lord, act." He doesn't say to his brother, "Well, that's not so great. I'm sorry to hear your news, Hanani. But actually, you know, I've got a pretty important job here in the palace, and I really hope things turn out well for you. But there's not much I can do from such a long way away, is there?" Now, notice by the end of his prayer, he has an idea. And I wonder whether it's through this persistent prayer, through dwelling in God's presence, through sharing his burdens, that he starts to think, "Well, maybe there is more that I can do. Maybe there's more than just praying. Maybe I could do something practical, something personal." So he ends by saying, "Give your servant success today by granting him favour in the presence of this man." Now I think, okay, who is this man that he's talking about? Well, he ends with this little footnote. "Oh, by the way, I was cupbearer to the king." Now, what is a cupbearer to the king? Well, you may be thinking some kind of waiter, some kind of butler figure. Maybe it sounds like quite a cozy job, you know, serve up a bit of wine every meal, go back, maybe finish it off yourself. Sounds quite cushy, doesn't it? Quite cozy. But I'm not sure it is such a cozy job. Remember, this is a violent time when a great empire like the Medes and the Persians would have many enemies, many people trying to assassinate the king, for example. So it's quite likely that the cupbearer would have to taste all the wine before the king drank it. Now, again, you may think this is quite a nice job, but actually, if you think quite a lot of people are trying to poison the king, then you're facing death at every sip. It's a very risky job, and it's also a job that you wouldn't just give to anybody. This is not just a waiter on a 0 hours contract. This is a trusted, close courtier. The closest comparison I could think of was the butler Carson in the TV series Downton Abbey. Okay, he has a servant's role. But if you've ever watched that series, you'll see that there is a close friendship between the master and the servant. The master trusts the servant and he even asks his advice as they're getting dressed in the mornings or the evenings. So far from being just a waiter, he would have been a leading civil servant in the court. He would have been a trusted, close courtier. But who was this king? Well, we can get a little insight into this king if we look at the inscription on this bowl below. I was very interested to find this in the British Museum a few years ago. And now the inscription on the bowl says, Artaxerxes, the great king, the king of kings, the king of countries, son of Xerxes the king, of Xerxes, son of Darius the king, the Achaemenian, in whose house this silver drinking cup was made. And the time is about 450 BC. So this was made in Artaxerxes' father or his grandfather's court, but was probably still in use. Now you may notice I said silver drinking cup. You might have been thinking of a nice sort of wine goblet that you drink wine out of. And this is the king of the biggest empire in the known world. You're going to have a wine cup. It's going to be the size of a salad bowl. I mean, that is huge. It's maybe more of a ceremonial drinking cup, but this is Artaxerxes. This is the king who Nehemiah is serving. This is another relief carving of this king as well. But it's an interesting contrast, isn't there? So this bowl is talking about Artaxerxes being the king of kings, but all Nehemiah says is the king, just the king. There's quite a contrast in chapter one. Who is the real king in this story? Who does Nehemiah praise? Who does he worship? Well, it's in there in verse 5. The Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God. Even though Artaxerxes is the greatest king the world that time ever knew, there is one who is far greater, far more powerful, and it's to him that Nehemiah prays and puts his trust. Now, as we move on to chapter 2, we see that there comes an opportunity. Now, if you work out the dates, you'll see there's 4 months between Nehemiah starting to pray and when this opportunity arises. So again, we see his persistence, we see his patience in prayer. When was the last time you prayed day and night for something for 4 months, I wonder? And when his opportunity arises, he takes it, he seizes it boldly. It's worth remembering that there was a great risk at appearing unhappy in the king's presence. That's why he's very much afraid in verse 2. His predecessor, Xerxes, was the one who almost certainly had Esther as a wife, and you may remember from her story that to even appear in the king's presence without being invited was to face death. This was a brutal and a vicious court. Even if it looked nice on the front, it was no t zero tolerance. And even to appear unhappy in the king's presence, you could be summarily executed. But notice again what Nehemiah does. He is respectful, but he is honest. And I guess it's a sign of their relationship, a sign of the king's concern for him and the queen's as well, that they listen to his request. Notice as well that little arrow prayer that goes up in verse 4. The king says to me, "What is it you want?" Quite a question. That's his chance. This is his opportunity. It's like someone saying, "So, tell me about this Jesus. Why is it that you follow Jesus?" Well, rather than just jumping in, he prays. Just a little arrow prayer, a little short prayer. God, give me the words to say. This is the chance. This is what you've prepared me for. And he asks, okay, can I go back and rebuild my city where my ancestors are from? And the king is pleased to let him go. But Nehemiah doesn't stop there. He doesn't just ask to go. He says, well, can you give me some letters for safe conduct? The king gives him those. He gives him troops and a whole army as well. And he says, well, what would be really useful is if I could get some wood to help rebuild the gates, because there's probably not much wood around locally. And the king says, yes, by all means. The gracious hand of God was on me. The king granted my requests. Verse 8. So he ends up going with cavalry, army officers, a whole entourage for his mission. And the king is pleased to see him go. What an opportunity. What an amazing act of grace. Now, when he gets to Jerusalem, again, he is a man of preparation. He is a man of not rushing in, not being hasty. Maybe his civil service background helped him in this regard. He thought, well, I'm not sure exactly what the extent of the problem is. I don't want to just go rushing in and say to the local Jews, right, chaps, let's crack on. I'm some posho foreigner from the royal household, but I know exactly what you need. Let me tell you what to do. No, he's very careful. He goes round in the night. He doesn't want to raise false hopes or false expectations. He wants to get a sense of the problem. So he goes round in secret around the walls. He inspects all the different parts of the walls before he then makes his appeal to the locals. Obviously, he will need all their support to actually build the walls. He'll need dozens of men and probably women and children as well to put these walls back together before their enemies realize and try and attack them before the walls are up. But he is prepared, he is careful. And then he gives his pitch. Verse 17, you see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the walls of Jerusalem and we will no longer be in disgrace. He tells them about how God has acted, at the amazing, miraculous, you might say, that way that God has provided already. And they're on board. They say, let's start rebuilding, and they begin this good work. So he's able to motivate. He is a great leader, as we will see in subsequent chapters. He tackles the problem. He's able to lead the people and inspire and motivate them. And by this point, hopefully he's appearing credible. He's not just some do-gooder from far away who thinks he knows what's best for the local people. He genuinely shares in their lives. But finally, notice that when God works, Satan works as well. Verse 19, when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked us and ridiculed us. What is this you're doing, they asked. Are you rebelling against the king? Notice how the lies are against the truth, like the snake in the Garden of Eden. Did God really say you couldn't eat that tree? Did the king really say you could do this? Are you sure you're not actually rebelling against him? Well, quite the opposite, and Nehemiah is having none of it. He responds boldly. He responds by more prayer, we'll see in chapter 4. But he is clear, he is confident. The God of heaven will give us success, verse 20. We are his servants. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. Now, there is more more opposition to come. We will see it comes in different forms. This is just the first level, a bit of a bad mouthing, a bit of fake news to try and discredit and dishearten the workers. But Nehemiah is focused. He is decisive and he is incredibly servant hearted. Let me finish by saying this is only the beginning of the story of Nehemiah. He goes on to amazing successes. He leads the people to great successes, but also great challenges as well. But he is a servant. He is a man of his people. He is a man of his God. He is close to his God. And in many ways, like several Old Testament leaders, he is a type or a foreshadowing of the true, the ultimate king, the ultimate leader who will come to earth to restore his people, to restore God's kingdom, and bring in a glorious reign which was never quite realized in the time of Nehemiah, which was never quite realized in the time of Solomon. The King Jesus, who came to rule and to reign like no other before him. But in these chapters of Nehemiah, we do get glimpses of that, glimpses of what it means to be prayerful, to be persistent, to be a man after God's heart. So as I close, let's continue to think about what it means to be a man or a woman or a child after God's heart, who comes into prayer daily, regularly, to meet with God, to share with God, and to do his work. Amen.